Joining us right now, Congressman Ron Kind. Piece of legislation that you just introduced has a lot to do with improving railroad safety. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, it's a crucial issue. With the increase of Bakken oil being transported through Wisconsin right now, we have to be working with state and local officials to better prepare, to guard against an accident, and then how do we respond to one if it happens. So today I introduced legislation called the Response Act, along with Senator Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota. And this would better coordinate federal, state, local, and private entities in developing a plan in which to respond in case there is an emergency. Right now, it's kind of checkerboard, haphazard in regards to the training and the resources and a coordinated response that might happen. This would pull all of it together in a more coherent, comprehensive fashion. And so we're trying to be proactive. We're trying to prevent anything from happening to begin with. But in light of 12 derailments nationwide so far and counting, you can never be too prepared or too coordinated at all levels to respond to an emergency.
Now, we've talked a little bit about rail safety in the past, and I know one of the things you'd mentioned is the efforts to get rid of some of the older rail cars that don't meet certain standards, but is that part of this legislation?
Well, no. The Surface Transportation Board at DOT has already issued a rule that does require the railroads to upgrade their tanker cars so that it is more modern, safer, less prone to rupture and therefore explosions. And the railroads, to their credit, have already been making this move. They just wanted to know what the specs were that they needed to hit with the new rail cars, because clearly the old fleet that exists now called the DOT 111s, those are the ones that are derailing, they're puncturing, they're blowing up with this very highly flammable, toxic Bakken oil. So even the railroads know that what they're currently using is inadequate. So the Surface Transportation Board, and working with folks like me and the railroads, are in the process of requiring that upgrade. And it makes sense business-wise. I mean, the railroads don't want to face that type of liability in the future. And if there are ways to have more modern rail cars that are safer and less likely to erupt, then it makes good business sense for them to do it.
Looking at the Response Act proposal, you've got several things here that look like they're targeting towards preparedness for responding to an emergency. But we have a rule in place right now where they're supposed to report to local management if they have trains with over 1 million gallons of this Bakken crude.
Right.
Is there a better way to report that to the agencies, or is that something that has to be covered separately?
Well, when that proposed rule came out, I immediately followed up with Surface Transportation Board why they're limiting it to 1 million gallons of this crude, when there should be complete transparency, and not just to the local responders, but to the community at large. So we know what's being transported, and therefore we know what risk we're facing and what the response is going to be. So trying to limit it, I think, is really slicing it a little bit too thin. I'm still working on that. Some disclosures better than none, so they are happening. They are going in the right direction. But I think, you know, to allay the concerns that are rising out there, and I'm hearing from a lot of folks at the local level, I think more transparency is going to be needed.
Are you finding that a lot of the people at the local level, everything from emergency management to just the residents in general, have thought for years, it's just a train going by. We don't know what's in it. We don't care. Now they actually care what's in that train.
Well, they do, and they should, because the product has changed. You know, for years it was a normal product. It was grain being shipped to market, but now it's this Bakken oil. And research and studies have shown that this is toxic. It's highly flammable, highly dangerous. It was a Bakken oil train that derailed in Quebec that killed 41 people last year in Canada. And we've had 12 more derailments here in the United States. And given that they're passing through highly populated areas, including right here in Wisconsin, it is a source of concern, and I think legitimately so. So I think the transparency, the steps taken to increase safety, slower train speeds, more track inspection, the upgrade of the cars, I'm pushing for the addition of a stabilization agent, which is fairly easy to manufacture. It's not that costly. It will take some of the more dangerous chemicals out of the oil that are prone to ignite and blow up. Texas already requires it. I mean, if it's good enough for Texas, then shoot. As far as our own safety concerns, it should be good enough for the upper Midwest. And that's, I think, going to be the next step that has to be taken to further safeguard any accidents.
You're not really able to tell one railroad that you can transport this product versus telling another one they can't just because of, you know, the way business regulations are. But you do have a unique situation on the western border where the BNSF tracks go right down the Mississippi River. Should something happen with a train on those tracks, does the Response Act give the local authorities the means and the procedures to deal with a spill on the river?
Well, that, too, has to be part of the preparedness planning, given the sensitivity of the area they're transporting through. Crossing the Mississippi, it's the largest wildlife refuge in the nation, and the tracks are very close to the watershed area and the river itself. You know, God forbid if there's a major spill that were to affect that ecosystem, and then it's going to not only affect our backyard, but flow all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. And the cleanup would be very, very difficult. So that, too, has to be a part of the planning, how to contain a spill, too, so it doesn't get into the watershed area.
Any consideration to perhaps having Army Corps of Engineers involved in the FEMA response, the local response to a cleanup on the river? Because with the locks and dams, you may be able to contain some of it using those.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the Corps is a logical agency that will inevitably get involved. You know, FEMA is going to be doing the coordination and find out where the gaps in planning are right now. And it's not just limited to public entities, whether it's federal, state, or local, but reaching out to private entities and what resources they can bring. Obviously, DOD, our Defense Department at Fort McCoy, can bring hazmat capability. It's probably the closest one right now. Some of the railroads are deploying hazmat trucks in areas that they view as vulnerable. So it's closer in proximity in case they need it. But, yeah, and that's why this legislation, I think, is necessary. There's a lot going on and churning out there, but not a whole lot of coordination that's taking place. And I'd hate to see redundancies and inefficiencies hold back good safety plans.
We do know that the infrastructure of the railroad is pretty well stressed right now. You've got a lot of oil coming across in tanker cars. You have a lot of hoppers sending frac sand out west. Someone asked me the question, I don't know the answer, maybe you've heard, but someone asked me if the railroad's bridges and track infrastructure is up to the task with this big increase in the number of trains and the tonnage. Because if the bridges can't hang in there and, say, the shipment of sand makes them weaker than they might be, do you want to ship oil over those bridges?
Well, you're exactly right. And historically, the maintenance of the track and therefore the safety of the track has been the purview, if not the sole jurisdiction of the railroads themselves. It's their money that goes in to upgrade it. Of course, it's in their interest to be able to move products, so I don't think they want a weak infrastructure at the same time. But I think additional oversight may be necessary because, you know, the bottom line is the bottom line, and many companies do tend to cut corners in order to save costs. And in this instance, it could cost lives. So I think that is going to have to be an item that we're looking at more closely. And there is going to be more wear and tear. The increase in volume of Bakken and frac sand, as you pointed out, has grown exponentially. And you still have the grain demand and the coal demand that's competing with that space on the track. And that's why last week, Representative Wallace from Minnesota and I sat down with BNSF officials to go over the rail capacity issue and whether or not some of these other businesses are being taken care of or if they're being relegated to the back of the line. I've heard from a lot of farmers in Wisconsin who are growing more anxious about their ability to get product to market, to be able to ship that grain, especially over to the river to transport it south. And it's becoming harder and more expensive for them to do it by rail just because of the Bakken oil competition.
I understand that Burlington Northern Santa Fe is doing some expansion, but is that just the addition of a second line through La Crosse, or are they looking at other areas too?
They are. It's just a four-mile line through the La Crosse community in order to better coordinate and make a more efficient flow of that traffic. But they're also doing double lines up through North Dakota and a double line in the southern part of the states that runs through Missouri in order to alleviate some of the traffic backlog. But this has become a very complex situation as far as rail transport. Darrell and Power, that provides the electricity for a lot of our rural electric co-ops, throughout the Midwest, we're 2 weeks shy of running out of coal in the middle of the polar vortex. And you can imagine the havoc that that would have created for businesses and residential homes alike. And they're trying to guard against that same thing with this upcoming winter, especially given the floodwaters that halted a lot of the barge traffic. So they're scrambling to play catch-up to make sure they have adequate supplies. And it was another reason why we met with BNSF, to make sure that that backlog is being addressed as quickly as possible before the river starts freezing over again.
One thing that's happening outside of your district, but you've probably heard about it or may have even seen some proposals, a lot of northern Wisconsin communities are very concerned about losing the rail lines they have because of the lack of ability to, say, ship lumber or bring in new industry. Is there anything you're aware of at the federal level that may help these local communities or maybe help the railroads keep these tracks operational, even though they are low-volume tracks?
Well, it's an interesting question, and there have been inquiries that I've received recently about that concern growing in northern Wisconsin. I think we've got to look into it. I think we've got to reach out to the railroad to find out why these decisions are being made. Although, at the end of the day, the government can't force a private entity to have to do something and continue service in an area if they can't economically maintain it. So I think there's a lot more information that we're going to need to find out what's going on and why. And I hope it's just not a situation where they see more profitable markets somewhere else and they're just cutting loose some of the less profitable lines right now and leaving those communities stranded.
Let's change topics. You have what was supposed to be the last day of the session, but I understand several of your colleagues are getting called back to Washington. What's happening over there?
Well, it's been difficult. Now, there are no easy lifts in Washington these days, and I think that's especially true within the Republican Party. They are literally at war with one another. They can't even write their own bill and get a majority of their own members to support it, let alone trying to get cooperation from us Democrats. And this situation involved the border issue with the children coming across, and how can we expedite the review process to process those kids and reunite them with families, do a better job of securing the border, but also taking care of the kids, because they are children after all. And while they are here, we've got to take care of them. And they tied themselves up into knots, and they came forward with a pretty draconian bill that really wouldn't fix the problem. And even with that, they couldn't come up with enough votes to pass it. So it had to be pulled at the very last minute. And that is delaying the departure for the August recess. Listen, I'm fine. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, and I think we ought to be staying in session. I was one calling for the Republican leadership to stay in during the month of August until we can develop consensus on a six-year highway trust fund bill. That's one of the best things we can do for job creation right now, is give our states and local communities the certainty and planning that they need to repair our fragile infrastructure system that will create jobs overnight. But instead of doing that, they're just passing a 10-month extension, kicking the can down the road, and missing an opportunity to help jumpstart our national economy again. So I'm all for staying in and getting some work done, but what isn't pleasant is watching the civil war taking place within the Republican Party, where it's so dysfunctional that they can't even vote for their own bills.
The transportation proposal you're speaking of, we've heard at the state level that the gas tax cannot support transportation needs over the long haul. Are you looking at something that may be able to help fund those issues as far as keeping the state and U.S. highways in good repair?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're on a collision course with fuel efficiency standards, how fuel efficient the modern auto fleet has become. And because the primary revenue source throughout the years has been the gas tax, with cars consuming less gas, it means less revenue going into the highway trust fund for the infrastructure repairs and building that we need. And it's one of the reasons I called on the leadership to stay in session in August so we can have hearings and bring panels before us, laying out the variety of options that are logical and make sense and that are fair to the people back home on how we're going to invest in our infrastructure system. We haven't even had a hearing on that for 2 years, and we knew that this highway trust fund was going to go broke in August. And then at the last minute, they're playing with budget gimmicks just to have a 10-month extension of the bill without any good information getting to members of Congress of what our options are. And that's what we need more now than ever, is what options can we explore, start talking amongst each other, get feedback at the local level, and develop the consensus to have a six-year bill rather than these stopgap short-term measures that no one likes at the end of the day.
We've heard a couple of people talk about maybe changing from a gallon-based gas tax to just putting as a sales tax with designated dollars to transportation. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, there are a variety of proposals. One is vehicles per miles traveled, so that it's basically a user fee. The more miles you're traveling on the road, then you'd be paying a little bit more into the Highway Trust Fund. And there are ways of calculating that now. Some hesitancy in doing it is some people don't feel comfortable with the federal government collecting that information as far as how much you're driving on the road, but I think you can get around that. Oregon, actually, the state of Oregon is already moving forward with their own version of this, and they're having a private contractor do it with safeguards to protect private information. And other proposals. We've got $2 trillion of corporate money locked up overseas. If we could bring some of that back and have that dedicated to the Highway Trust Fund, that would be another revenue source that could go a long ways for some long-term planning. And I know there's some folks back in Wisconsin have been raising the issue of some tolling capability like Illinois has, and that way you're able to capture some of the vehicles from out of state that are coming in and using our roads and bridges and highways. None of this is easy, and none of it is without controversy, but I think the American people realize that we've got a deteriorating infrastructure system. If we don't want to look like a third-world nation by delaying what we all know needs to be done, then we're going to have to start making some tough decisions again and not be afraid to explore them together without finger-pointing and laying blame on someone else.
You mentioned there's $2 trillion overseas. Whose money is that?
Well, that's corporate money that is over there because they don't want to bring it back in the United States and get hit with taxes. So they can what's called defer that income, and as long as it's kept overseas and they don't bring it back to the U.S. shore, it would never be taxed. And so that's one of the problems we have with our tax code right now, leaving our businesses less competitive globally. And because of that phenomenon, you're hearing a lot of stories about companies that are trying to invert, and they're finding a smaller company overseas that they can buy and then claim that's the parent company, so it moves their tax jurisdiction to a lower tax country in order to avoid U.S. corporate taxes.
And that's the topic that your colleague, Senator Baldwin, has some legislation on the floor with right now.
Yeah, and it's bad because it's easy to do. And right now, given the loopholes that exist with the federal tax code, companies can do that. And it's not illegal, although I think it's wrong. But it's a reason why we have to reform our tax code to try to make it more competitive, but also fair for all people. Right now, it's not fair when you've got a mom-and-pop small business operating on Main Street, wherever in America, having to pay their taxes, and you've got these large Fortune 500 companies moving their domicile overseas in order to avoid all U.S. taxes. And yet, their corporate headquarters stay in America, their manufacturing stays in America, everything that they normally do stays in America, they're just not paying American taxes anymore. And part of the problem I have is that they enjoy a global marketplace with relative stability and peace because of the U.S. military. Well, that's a very expensive bill in the federal budget every year. Someone's going to have to pay for that. And the very companies that are benefiting from the blanket of security that the U.S. military provides, and no one else is doing it, they are unwilling to chip in to help pay for that cost. So it's very disappointing to see these companies quick to jump shore to avoid any type of tax liability when they're benefiting with the very nature of our country and the benefits that drive from it.
One other topic we should definitely cover. As of the time of this interview, you and the House have already voted, but the Senate still has it on today's agenda, and that is the Veterans Access to Care Act. I understand that this one sailed through the House like 420-5, if I remember right.
Yeah, it was pretty overwhelming because it's not the perfect cure-all. We still have a lot of work to reform and modernize that VA system and especially cut down on the wait period for veterans to get in. But it was a step in the right direction again. And it does provide greater options for veterans. So if they are delayed in getting into a VA medical center or outpatient clinic, they can go to a private provider, get the treatment that they need, especially if it's urgent, and that would be reimbursed by the VA. So it does empower and gives veterans more options. But I still think we are in need of a bipartisan blue ribbon commission to do a top-down, bottom-up review of the VA system and come forward with a list of recommended steps that the Congress should be taking in order to improve the care and access that our veterans need within the VA medical system. So this is something that I think we've got to stay focused on. It's big, and as we peel back the layers, we realize how complicated this is, too, and we're just going to have to get the job done.
You had an easy vote in the House. Any word from across the hall as far as the Senate voting? You think this will go through pretty well?
Yeah, it's receiving good bipartisan support. You know, to credit to Senator Bernie Sanders in the Senate and Jeff Miller in the House, they conferenced, they worked together and compromised on a bill that could be acceptable. And, again, that was shown with the wide bipartisan support coming out of the House.